after the Constitution of India coming into effect, Jawaharlal Nehru wrote this to all of the chief ministers, and I quote, "It is the right of the judiciary to interpret the Constitution and to apply it, and none of us can or should challenge that. But if the Constitution itself comes in our way, then surely it is time to change that Constitution to that extent. It is impossible to hang up urgent social changes because the Constitution comes in the way, according to the interpretation of the courts." What were these social changes that Nehru talked about that were so profound that he had to amend the fundamental rights of the Constitution just a year after the Constitution was enacted? And all of this just to allow the Parliament to pass laws of the sorts that the High Courts and the Supreme Court would outrightly declare them unconstitutional. And anticipating this action, the amendment prohibited the Supreme Court and the High Courts from declaring these laws unconstitutional. Also, was the Nehru government justified for passing these laws by a temporary parliament instead of waiting for Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha elections? This is Hamlet of Law, an Indian legal podcast where we discuss judgments of Indian courts, the laws, policies, and the politics behind these laws and policies, and everything official to judicial. Stay tuned to find out. This is your host Naren Rudra, and this is the inaugural episode of the podcast. In this episode, we'll explore the very controversial First Amendment to the Constitution and how this amendment diluted the property rights of the citizens by validating zamindari abolition laws with a questionable procedure and without a proper mandate. This too, just 15 months after the Constitution was ratified. We'll discuss why the Nehru government amended the Constitution this soon after it was enacted, and also how the Supreme Court dealt with the validity of this amendment by forming the first ever constitutional bench in the matter of Shankari Prasad versus Union of India. And unlike traditional sources on the subject, we'll be equally focusing on the arguments made in the cases as well, because this case and all cases of constitutional significance have very wide repercussions, and the lawyers involved in these cases are the best and brightest in the country, so their arguments, clarity of thought, their depth in the subject, and the way they articulate everything is as good as they can get. So I'll be focusing on arguments as well. Now, before going ahead, keep in mind that the First Amendment broadly made five changes. 1. It allowed the state to restrict free speech. 2. It allowed the state to earmark seats in government jobs and colleges for socially and educationally backward classes. 3. It restricted trade and business by allowing very invasive government interference on the pretext of regulations. 4. It validated zamindari abolition laws. And lastly, 5. It created Schedule 9 and prohibited the courts from declaring laws unconstitutional if inserted in Schedule 9. We'll just discuss the laws abolishing zamindari system, Schedule 9, and how this amendment was passed in this episode. So, let's get down to it. India fought very hard for its independence, and it was a true moment of joy when Britain's Parliament passed the Indian Independence Act 1947 and ordering dominions of India and Pakistan to be demarcated by midnight of August 14th and 15th of 1947, and then transfer all of the powers to India and Pakistan. For the first time ever, Indians actually had the power to elect their leaders, but there was no framework set out yet to elect leaders. So for the time being, the British government virtually transferred the powers to the interim government, which was elected by a body which was formed to draft the constitution, the Constituent Assembly. And this interim government, more or less unchanged, went on to perform all the duties of the Union Cabinet until Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha elections were held. The administration aspect was taken over by the interim government. On the other hand, the parliamentary functions were performed by something called the temporary parliament, or as it's also called, the provisional parliament. This provisional parliament was called the Constituent Assembly for close to 3 years because it was given the task of drafting the constitution, and this body was elected indirectly, and a significant number of them were just delegates from the princely states. Members to these bodies were elected by the state legislatures, which was in turn elected under the Government of India Act 1935, and under this act, only members of certain education qualifications and people with certain amount of property were eligible. So this Constituent Assembly was not really representative, but it was very much qualified to draft the constitution. And the Congress back then ensured that this Constituent Assembly was as diverse as it could get. So after fully framing the Constitution, it was ratified by the Constituent Assembly, and then this assembly became the Provisional Parliament until Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha elections were held. So this is the reason why this body is called Temporary or Provisional Parliament. So the same body was called Constituent Assembly until January 26, 1950 and Provisional Parliament from January 26, 1950 till the Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha were summoned. Interestingly, the elections were held a little late because the country hadn't yet settled on a lot of things like voting age, communal electorates, presidential or prime ministerial form of government, and finally settled on these aspects on the basis of constitutional principles, and then passed the Representation of People Act, and the elections were held according to this law. Meanwhile, from independence till 1952, the Provisional Parliament was acting as a parliament at the center, and the newly independent state governments were formed by the Congress leaders, who were again mostly elected under the Government of India Act 1935, before independence. Now, these newly independent states had a lot of social problems to deal with, and one of the biggest was unequal distribution of lands, where a few people held lands that spread across hundreds and even thousands of villages. And this system and this sort of accumulation of lands has a lot of history to it. And to understand why the government diluted our property rights and why it enacted the laws that take away the lands from the so-called zamindars and redistributed all of these lands to the farmers, we have to understand the deeper history behind it. So, by the time India achieved independence, and also for the most part of the modern history, small farmers never actually owned their lands. They used to lease them out for a rather hefty price from the zamindars. Now, zamindars or jagirdars were these huge landholders who got these lands as grants by the government itself or the kings and princely states. And the less discussed side about zamindars and all of this distribution of land is, they didn't get this land by just loitering around. The state used to allot them these lands in return for some service to the state, that too mostly military service through their private army. The other way where zamindars got all of these lands was, the kings or the British used to auction off huge tracts of lands again to a person who promises to pay the highest periodical tax. And in case they fail to pay the tax or fall short of it, the government would simply take away the land from them. Now, zamindars also used to develop the land under their control, mostly by maintaining proper roads, ensuring free water flow, and developing infrastructure in general, because a proper ecosystem in their land would ensure easy produce of crop, meaning the farmers could earn more money, and with this money, the farmers could easily pay the land tax to the zamindars. Now, we're digressing a little bit, but it's interesting to know that this land tax is what we call land revenue. And land revenue was a major chunk of earnings for both the British and the kings. So that's why they used to be very stringent and harsh while collecting land tax. And the person who's in charge of collecting land tax is called a collector, because he used to collect land tax. And this collector was virtually the most powerful person in a defined area. And we still retain the name collector to refer to the head of the district collector. Interestingly, we call land laws revenue laws because the government used to frame laws to maintain records of ownership and possession of lands only to collect revenue. So, lands dealing with ownership and possession in general are called revenue laws. Now, back to the topic. This zamindari system was very much thriving when we got independence, and for the reference, in the later part of the 1940s, 72% of India's population was engaged in farming, and out of that, only a small fraction, less than 1%, was actually owning the land they till, and almost everyone were tenants of some or the other zamindar. For example, in Awadh, which was a princely state comprising of current-day central Uttar Pradesh, 60% of land was under zamindar's control, and Uttar Pradesh was the biggest state by population even back then, with 17% of India's population living there. And if we come further down to the south, in Madras Presidency, 33% of total land was owned by zamindars. So with these numbers, you can understand the magnitude of inequality with respect to land holdings in India. This system wasn't fair to the farmers because most of India wasn't educated, and the only way to eke out a living was farming. So they needed land to survive, and for this land, they had to pay taxes to the zamindars or the government directly. And after paying these taxes, they would be left with just enough resources to have a basic living. And on top of that, there would be no security over their livelihood, because if they fall short of paying the tax or if they just refuse to, they used to simply get evicted from the lands. And more often than not, they used to get evicted from the lands because they couldn't afford to pay this land tax regularly, because either it was way too high or they couldn't produce any crop for that season or for a host of other reasons. There were actually cases where zamindars supported the British during the independence movement because they were thriving under their system, and they knew that with the socialist agendas of the new freedom fighters, they would not let this zamindari system continue for long. Now, with this ruthless system in place, the farmers just wanted a way out and have a safe, secure and content livelihood, and the Congress and communist leaders promised just that. After independence, our constitution framers envisioned India as a socialist welfare state with little to no inequality, and this has also been the ideology of Indian National Congress, especially on the property front, and this can be seen from Congress endorsing the abolition of zamindari system strongly from way back in the 1930s. Finally, after independence, the Congress government came to power and they started discussing seriously to get away with this inequality, and the straightforward option was to take away all the lands from the zamindars except for a few hectares and redistribute this collected land to the farmers themselves. After independence, the Congress party formed government everywhere. It got majority of votes in almost all of the state legislatures in elections held before independence under the 1935 Act, and also in the 1952 general elections, it comfortably passed the majority mark in parliament, and guided by these socialist welfare state principles, the Indian National Congress carried out huge agrarian reforms. Now, India's governance has a few elements of federalism, so states are in a way a sovereign in a sovereign state, and on a few issues, states have no higher authority over them. Whatever the state says, that is it, that is final. So with this federal structure, the states have exclusive control over a few subjects such as public order, lands, prisons, public health, and no authority, not even the union government, can interfere with these powers. This distribution of powers between union and the states is listed out in Schedule 7 of the Constitution, and this schedule has three heads. The first and second are union list and state list, which have subjects that are exclusively under the union's control and the state's control. Then the third one is concurrent list, where both union and states can frame laws, but once the union frames any law on any subject in the list, the laws that were framed by the state stand repealed to that extent, and the laws passed by the union will take the ground. Now, in very extreme cases, union government can make laws that are in the state list too, but as I said, they are very extreme and they hardly ever happen. Now, the subject of land is in the state list, so states have the exclusive right to frame laws and policies on land, and since the state governments were again formed by the Congress party, the states carried out these huge land reform laws all across the country. But the most affected parts were the northern states, because the zamindari system was a Mughal vestige and Mughals' influence in southern India is very little and it's very pervasive in northern India. So, all of these states passed these land reform laws acquiring almost all of the lands of the zamindars. For example, if a zamindar owned 120 acres, the state limited the ownership at 40 acres and would go on to acquire the rest of the 80 acres, and that too without any equitable or reasonable compensation for acquiring such excess land. Then the state enabled itself to redistribute all of these lands to the farmers, that too mostly in such a manner that where the farmer who used to till the land as a tenant was given the ownership of that very land. And after successfully passing these laws, one of their long-standing agendas were fulfilled. They have been promising the land reform laws from way back in the 1930s. Now, as soon as these laws were passed, zamindars started approaching the local politicians and other people in power and tried to convince them to roll back these new land reform laws. But the highest rung of Congress party was very adamant and didn't even budge an inch, and wanted to go ahead with this abolition and the system at any cost. With these talks still underway, the zamindars moved to the high courts through writs under Article 226 and attacked the validity of these zamindari abolition laws. Since it was just 1951, Article 31 and Article 19(1)(f), both of which protected property rights and any undue interference of state on the property, were very much alive, because they were repealed all the way in 1978 through the 44th Amendment. So the zamindars in the High Court argued that these laws were violative of their right to property because the government was depriving them of their land without any fair compensation. And this word compensation has a lot of history in Indian jurisprudence, but we'll discuss that in another episode. Now, the zamindars here challenged the laws as violative of Article 31, of which Clause 1 reads, and I quote, "No person shall be deprived of his property save by authority of law," unquote. And Clause 2 of the same article mandates that any acquisition by state shall be for the public purpose and must compensate the owner of the property if the state were to acquire it. And also, the zamindars challenged them on the ground that it violates Article 19(1)(f). Which protects an individual's right to acquire, hold and dispose of his property. Since these laws were challenged in multiple high courts and decision of one high court is not binding on other high courts, the orders and judgments were not uniform across India. The Patna High Court, in the very famous case of Kameshwar Singh versus State of Bihar, declared Bihar's land reform laws unconstitutional, while the Allahabad High Court was yet to decide on the constitutionality but passed a string of injunctions which restrained the state from acquiring any property under the new land reforms, and a few other high courts upheld the constitutionality. Here, interestingly, the Patna High Court didn't declare the state's land reform laws unconstitutional because the government didn't have the eminent domain, that is, the power to acquire land of any citizen, and that such power was violative of Article 31 and 19(1)(f). The Patna High Court declared them unconstitutional because Bihar's laws were discriminating while compensating the landholders. For example, here the compensation for lands acquired from an individual with huge land holdings was significantly lower than that of landlords with small land holdings. And this unequal treatment was clearly violative of Article 14, and for this reason it was declared unconstitutional. And also, interestingly, when this case was appealed to the Supreme Court, it was none other than B.R. Ambedkar who argued in the Supreme Court against the zamindars. Unsurprisingly, in all these cases where the states lost, they appealed to the Supreme Court, and where the petitioners lost, even they appealed to the Supreme Court. And while all these cases were pending and all these appeals were pending, the Union government was very flustered with these judgments and court orders because they came in the way of these long overdue reforms and also the past promises of the Congress government. So they wanted to override all these judgments through an amendment to the Constitution, which will effectively provide for land acquisition and among host of other things. Now, various high courts also declared a few other laws void for violating fundamental rights and therefore barred the executive, that is the police and other enforcing officers, from a lot of their actions. For example, the Madras High Court in Champakan Durai Rajan case struck down caste reservations for being violative of Article 14, the Equality Clause in the Constitution. And in Romesh Thapar and Brij Bhushan cases, the Supreme Court struck down orders of a state branch which banned circulation or publication of a magazine that was critical of Nehru government, and nullified government actions that restricted freedom of speech for being violative of Article 19(1)(a). With all these court orders in place, the state governments were unable to carry out these land reforms. The Nehru government didn't want any obstacles to these reforms, and it was also very resolute on undoing the court orders, and amendment to the constitution looked like the only option. The Congress government wanted to amend the fundamental rights of the very constitution, which it played a huge role in framing. The Congress government here was heavily opposed while trying to amend the constitution, even by the President of India. One of the criticisms of this amendment was that the Nehru government just passed the amendment when elections were right around the corner. And since the land reforms took a big pause, and as a result of this, the people got dissatisfied with the Congress, and to win the people back, the Nehru government passed this amendment in haste because the Communist Party, which was the only strong contender to Congress back then, promised to solve all of these issues if voted to power, and the Communist Party and their ideas actually started gaining traction by this time. Now, what's the process to amend the Constitution? First, a member of a parliament can propose a change to the constitution, and this proposal will be presented in text in either of the house, and this is called a bill. Now, any bill becomes an act when it's successfully passed by Lok Sabha, Rajya Sabha, and after receiving the assent of the president. Now, under Article 368, a bill to amend the constitution must first be tabled either in Lok Sabha or in Rajya Sabha. Then such bill must get approval of 2/3 of the members present in voting. So another condition here is such 2/3 of assenting members shall not be less than half of the total number of seats in such house. So in Lok Sabha, it should get at least 245 votes and 164 in Rajya Sabha. Once the bill gets approval in both Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha, it will be sent to the president. Here, only after the president assents to the bill, it will become an act and will come into force. And all of this and this type of approval is called a special majority. And half of the state legislatures in the country must also ratify an amendment to the constitution if, only if, it affects the federal structure of the country or takes away the jurisdictions of the high courts or alters the powers of the high court judges. The number of states that require to ratify is 15, which is half of the total number of state legislatures in the country. The recent event of this happening was with the NJAC amendment, which read with other laws, essentially formed a procedure to appoint and transfer High Court and Supreme Court judges, which until then were appointed by the members of the judiciary itself. This amendment was ratified by 16 state legislatures, but was struck down by the Supreme Court a little later because this National Judicial Appointment Commission included the union ministers and members outside of the judiciary. And since such inclusion is a detriment to independence of judiciary and hence violative of the basic structure of the constitution, it was declared unconstitutional. And we'll discuss this issue in the later episode of the podcast. Now, there are just a few types of amendments that just require simple majority, that is, assent of 50% of total members present and voting, but these type of amendments won't really affect the states or people in general in any way, so that's why it doesn't require this special majority. Now, be mindful of the fact that it's still 1951 and there were no elections yet, so there was no Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha. Despite the fact that there was no Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha, the Nehru government wanted an amendment to the constitution at any cost. So, it invoked the powers of president under Article 392. This Article 392 allowed the president to remove any difficulties by changing a few provisions of the constitution temporarily for transition of the government from the old Government of India Act 1935 to the new constitution. This 1935 Act was in a way a precursor to our constitution, and I reiterate, the president could only invoke Article 392 powers to help in transition of a government and not for any other reason. The president of India, who acts on the advice of the cabinet headed by the prime minister again, passed the constitution removal of difficulties order number 2, which allowed the provisional parliament, a single body, to pass a successful amendment to the constitution where the involvement and approval of both the houses is mandated by the very constitution they were trying to amend. This constitution order number 2 substituted almost all phrases that allude to a bicameral parliament, such as that house or each house or either house, with the words suggesting unicameral or a single housed parliament, to qualify the existing single-housed provisional parliament to amend the constitution, where again the involvement of both the houses was mandated. And all of this was again done invoking the powers of Article 392, which could only be used to remove difficulties, that too for transition of the government. Now, also keep in mind that Article 379 vests all the powers of the parliament in the provisional parliament until both the houses of parliament have been duly constituted and summoned to meet for the first session. And it also reads, the provisional parliament shall exercise all the powers and perform all the duties conferred by the provisional parliament of this constitution on parliament. Now, with this procedural obstacle 2 out of the way, the provisional parliament passed the first amendment to the constitution with a few changes to the bill after being tabled and discussed in the provisional parliament. As Dr. Tripandanam Singh talks in his book Stormy 16 Days, the first president Rajendra Prasad wrote this to A.K. Iyer. Iyer was one of the draftsmen of the constitution, and Prasad was expressing his displeasure and was also inquiring into the process employed by the Nehru government for amending the constitution, because the government essentially allowed the amendment to be successfully passed despite there not being Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha, that too on the back of this constitution order by the president, which could only be passed for transition of government. Here I'm quoting an excerpt directly from Prasad's letter to A.K. Iyer. Is it the duty of the president to assent to the bill even when he knows them to be ultra vires, particularly in the view of Article 60, where he is required by his oath of office, to the best of his ability, to preserve, protect, and defend the constitution? Unquote. but he very reluctantly gave his assent to the amendment in mid-1951, with a lot of chaos and objections to the amendment in the Provisional Parliament. But with the persistence of Nehru, the amendment took the shape of Constitution First Amendment Act 1951. Now, this amendment made a lot of changes, a lot of important changes, and just one of them was about land. The amendment first allowed the state to discriminate a person on the basis of caste to advance members of backward classes by providing caste-based reservations in government jobs and all education institutions, and then saved all of these laws from any attack on the ground that they violate Article 15. Article 15 forbids the state from discriminating a person on the basis of caste, race, sex, religion, and place of birth. Then, it added new grounds to restrict free speech, which are, and I quote, public order, friendly relations with foreign states, and incitement to an offense. Third, it allowed the state to acquire estates without any equitable compensation. Fourth, it introduced one extra schedule, Schedule 9 in Article 31, which essentially protected laws from any attack if just inserted in 9th schedule. So if any statute is inserted in Schedule 9, you can't move to the court and contend that a provision or section of this law is violative of my fundamental rights, so it must be declared unconstitutional. You simply have to follow it however unfair it might be. This provision was inserted because in a lot of cases, the court struck down a few sections or prohibited executive actions for violating fundamental rights of the citizens. And the state, which naturally craves for wider executive powers, wanted certain actions of the state to be insulated from court orders and judgments. And with respect to land reform laws especially, Article 31 and Article 19(1)(f) were grounds for the court to stop the state from acquiring any land. So, the government intended on inserting just land reform laws initially in this schedule, but now it went on to insert over 280 laws as of June 2021 in this schedule. And it was V.K. Thiruvengatachari, the former Advocate General of Madras, who proposed Schedule 9. And also, our former Chief Justice of India, Gajinder Gadkar, is popularly believed to have said that, and I quote, "Ours is the only constitution which had a provision providing for protection against itself," unquote. Lastly, the amendment allowed the state to nationalize any trade or business and barred the courts from declaring laws providing for nationalization invalid on the ground that these laws violate right to trade and business, which is clearly guaranteed in Article 19(1)(g). Without any surprise, the Zamindars again challenged this amendment in the High Courts and the Supreme Court, contending that the amendment is illegal and unconstitutional. They challenged the amendment on both substantial as well as procedural grounds. So the Supreme Court clubbed all the connected matters with the Shankari Prasad versus Union of India, citation 1951 SCJ 775. And ultimately decided the constitutionality of the amendment. And curiously, the Supreme Court here didn't use any local precedents in this matter. It just used one or two judgments of foreign courts. That's it. The rest of it was pure interpretation. So, these are the facts leading up to the case. And now let's analyze the property aspect of the First Amendment a little in depth. This amendment added Articles 31A and 31B. 31A gave the state the power to acquire any property. Now, property is not just lands and buildings and other tangible assets. Property means anything that belongs to you and anything on which you have a legal claim over. It doesn't matter whether it belongs to you for a limited time or forever. It just has to belong to you. And because the property belongs to you, you have the right to use such property. And this right to use is an inherent element of any property. For example, if you enter into a lease, you have a right there in this rented premises, and this premises is your property and belongs to you for as long as the lease subsists. And because this is your property, you can move to the court if it's unduly taken away from you. Similarly, holding shares in a company's property, creative work such as a song or a book or a poem is also a property. If you pay Netflix Rs. 800 for a month, your access to Netflix for that month too is your property. So if you rent a car for one day, the car is also your property for that day. So property is not limited to tangible or just intangible assets. And after amendment, Article 31 gave the state the power to acquire all and any sorts of property. Now, the state is entitled to eminent domain, that is the power to acquire any privately held property from any person, but with two conditions. One, it has to award reasonable compensation, and two, with a reasonable notice so that the private parties can arrange for another viable alternative to do whatever they were doing with such property before. Here, Article 31 gave the state the power to acquire any property without any reasonable compensation and without any reasonable notice. So, this new Article 31A allowed the state to just walk in and take over any property like lands or buildings or even management of a company. Now, this right to management, because right to manage a company is an offshoot of the ownership of such company, which is again considered as private property. So, exercise of such power was in direct violation of a person's right to property. Now, since Article 31A used the word all, it allowed the state to even replace the directors and managers of a private companies with government officials, or even to acquire lease rights of a private party, or to acquire any interest in any agreement entered by private parties. So all these things again with little to no compensation. On the other hand, Article 31B created Schedule 9, which is like a defense wall for all unconstitutional laws. It would defend all these laws, however unfair they might be, however arbitrary they might be. But as you know, this amendment also made three other changes, but those are not the subject matter of Shankari Prasad case, so we'll not be discussing that in this episode. Now, before going ahead, keep in mind that Article 13.2 very clearly forbids the state from enacting any law that takes away the fundamental rights of the citizens. And this amendment was brought by a temporary body, which the constitution calls the Provisional Parliament. So, what were the issues in the Shankari Prasad case? The first one was, is the Provisional Parliament even competent to amend the constitution? Because Article 368 calls for a cooperative action of both Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha, and there was no Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha, it was just the Provisional Parliament. So, is this amendment valid? The second issue was, does Article 368 contain every little detail there is about an amendment to the constitution? Because the Provisional Parliament here didn't pass the bill as it was presented. It made a few changes here and there after debating and discussing, and Article 368 didn't mention that a change can be made to a constitution amendment bill once officially presented in the House. So, is changing a few provisions of this bill not permissible as per Article 368? And if it is not permissible, is this amendment still valid? The third issue was, did the amendment limit the jurisdiction of the High Courts, because it indirectly restrained the High Courts and the Supreme Court from hearing any cases that challenge laws inserted in Schedule 9? Now, if we assume that this amendment did actually cut courts' jurisdiction, Article 368 clearly mandates that in case of any change to the jurisdiction of the High Courts and the Supreme Court, half of the total number of state legislatures must pass a resolution approving of the amendment. And since the state didn't pass any resolution, is the amendment still valid? The fourth issue was, is the President's order under Article 392 that allowed the Provisional Parliament to pass the amendment without there being Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha valid? And was the President's order even justified? Because such powers could only be used for transition of power to the independent government and to remove difficulties during such transition, and the order did not help with either of these things. The fifth issue was, are fundamental rights so supreme that they're even out of the reach of the parliament? And is an amendment taking away these fundamental rights of the citizens null and void? Because Article 13.2 clearly says that a law that violates fundamental rights is invalid and a bad law, be it in the present, past, or the future. The sixth issue, which is somewhat related to issue number 5, was, is an amendment to the constitution considered as a change in law? The last and final seventh issue was, since this amendment inserted laws relating to land in Schedule 9, and only the state governments have the right to deal with land and anything relating to land, did this amendment encroach on the state's exclusive power by inserting this in Schedule 9? And for this reason, is the amendment still valid? Now, this is my favorite part. We'll now delve into how the petitioners attacked the amendment and how the state countered and tried to justify this amendment. Now, in general, states have a head start in these sort of cases because all the laws are presumed to be constitutional, so all of what state has to do is to defend them. The first argument of the petitioner was, it is correct that Article 379 granted a few powers of the actual parliament to the provisional parliament, but the phrase all the powers in Article 379 means only those powers that could be exercised by a single house, because Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha have a few exclusive powers and the constitutional frame is intended on transferring only these exclusive powers, because transferring the powers of two different bodies which essentially have two different interests and different types of mandate to a single body was not at all reasonable. And also there are deeper reasons so as to why there are two houses of the parliament and why the involvement of both the houses is crucial. So they made the assent of two bodies mandatory, and because there were no two bodies in this case, the amendment is void. To this, the state countered by arguing that parliament is a recipient of powers of Article 368, and the phrase all the powers in Article 368 means just that, all the powers of the parliament, and it includes the power to amend the constitution as well. So there's no reason to exclude the amending powers from the phrase all the powers. So under Article 379, the provisional parliament was very much competent to amend the constitution. After hearing both the sides, Supreme Court rejected the arguments of the petitioners and held that the frame has anticipated that a representative parliament cannot be formed until after some time, so they have made the provisional parliament the recipient of the actual parliament and granted these powers through Article 379. Now, the phrase all the powers of the parliament in Article 379 shall be interpreted widely and not just in relation to Article 368. Now, while rejecting the arguments of the petitioners, the court said that if we as the highest court of the land accept this argument, it would rob the essence of Article 379 and virtually all the parliamentary actions would be stopped until the elections are held. And this would pose a lot of things and would stop the functioning of the entire government. And to precisely avoid this type of interpretation, the framers included Article 392, which confers a general power on the president to adopt the provisions of the constitution. The second argument by the petitioner was, the Constitution Removal of Difficulties Order No. 2, made by the President on 26 January 1950, was not warranted in any stretch of imagination, because Article 392 empowers the President to remove difficulties only in transition from the old British government to the newly formed independent government. And removing difficulties meant only those difficulties that were experienced in the actual working of the constitution during the transition, not for these amendments, because the government can function normally without any hiccups if this amendment was not passed. So this means for the president to pass any constitution orders intending on removing difficulties, two things must be satisfied. First, there must be an obstacle in transition of powers from the original 1935 Act to the current day constitution, and two, such obstacle must interfere with the basic functions of the government. Now, since the original constitution was neither an obstacle in transition of powers nor was a constitution blocking the basic functions of the government, and this order doesn't even assist the provisional parliament with discharge of the basic functions. On top of that, the order was passed on 26 January 1950, and no difficulty of working of the constitution could possibly have been experienced on the very date of the commencement of the constitution. So for all these reasons, the constitution order number 2 must be declared unconstitutional and illegal. To this, the state responded by arguing that we must not give any technical meaning to the word difficulties, and Article 392 uses the term difficulties, and since there not being two houses of a parliament to pass an amendment is a procedural barrier and hence it is a difficulty, the president passed an order and removed it. And this is well within the bounds of Article 392, so it is not unconstitutional. After listening to both the arguments, the Supreme Court rejected the argument of the petitioners and held that the phrase any difficulties used in Article 392 was intended to be as wide as possible. So the framers left the powers general instead of listing out specific classes of difficulties, since that would defeat the purpose of Article 392. For example, if we adopt the interpretation of the petitioners, it would stop the government from estimating the expenditure of Consolidated Fund of India under Article 112 and 113. Because it requires involvement of both the houses of the parliament, and this part was essential to run a government during the transitional period. Also, it is true that the difficulties must exist before removing them through an order, but they can also exist before an occasion for their removal actually arises. Now, as the terms and procedure weren't favorable for the provisional parliament to function, and to avoid this obstacle, the president has changed a few terms by modifying the language. Also, there's nothing in the constitution to suggest that the president should wait till a difficulty actually arose for the provisional parliament. And here too, the president didn't change the requirement of special majority to amend the constitution, which is the essence of the Article 368. So, the constitution order is valid and constitutional. So, the constitution removal of difficulties order number 2 is very much valid and constitutional. Another argument by the petitioner was, since the amendment barred the high courts and the Supreme Court from declaring these zamindari abolition laws unconstitutional for violating the fundamental rights, it cut down on the jurisdictions of the high courts and the Supreme Court, especially curtailing the powers of Article 32, 226, 132 to 136. Since the amendment required ratification of at least half of the state assemblies as mentioned in Article 368, and since the states haven't ratified it, the amendment is unconstitutional. To this, the states argued that high courts and the Supreme Courts test the validity of laws on the basis of fundamental rights. Now, after the amendment, the fundamental rights were modified, and if the high courts and the Supreme Courts were to test the validity of these new laws against the new modified fundamental rights, they couldn't pass any orders, again because of the new fundamental rights, not because the amendment cut down the jurisdiction of the high courts and the Supreme Court. So, ultimately, the court's jurisdiction wasn't cut off. On this issue, the Supreme Court accepted the arguments of the state and it held that the amendment doesn't seek to affect the jurisdiction of courts in any manner. Article 31A saves laws of compulsory acquisition of certain kind of property by the state from any attack on the ground that it's violated of fundamental rights. And Article 31B validates a few statutes and regulations already passed by the legislatures. So generally, the courts strike down laws that violate fundamental rights. And with this amendment, these fundamental rights are amended. And as a result of this new change, there won't be any occasion to exercise such power. So the courts could no longer interfere with a few classes of cases. This was not because the government just walked in and made laws prohibiting the courts from hearing any new cases. The jurisdiction of the courts wasn't altered in any way. The jurisdiction remains just the same. The only difference now is that only a certain class of cases have been excluded from the purview of Part 3, and as a result of this, there would be no occasion hereafter to exercise such powers. Now, this is some information one needs to know to fully comprehend further arguments. There are two types of powers of the parliament. The first one is lawmaking power, which is called legislative power, and the second one is constitution amending powers, which is called the constituent power. This is one of my favorite arguments. So here the petitioner argued that while passing legislative bills, the constitution granted powers to both Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha to make changes to the bill after debating and discussing in the house. In case the Lok Sabha or Rajya Sabha didn't reach any consensus on the changes to the bill, a joint sitting would be called by the president and then they'll take a vote and whichever change gets over 50% of the vote will be retained and will be passed as a law after president's assent. But in case of an amendment to the constitution, it must be passed without any changes after it was presented in either Lok Sabha or Rajya Sabha. This is because Article 368 is a full and complete code about a constitution amendment, and in this full code, there's no mention of changing any provisions of an amendment bill after presenting it in the parliament. So, there's no such mention here because in case of an ordinary bill, Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha can make changes to a bill and if there's a deadlock, they can resolve it through joint sitting, and all of this is clearly mentioned in Article 108. Now, if we allow Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha to change a few provisions of an amendment bill after presenting it, and if neither of the houses agrees to changes made by the other house, there's no way out of this deadlock. And if we allow either house to make any change, the entire constitution machinery would break down and no amendment to the constitution can be passed. And because Article 368 is a full and complete code, if there were to be a way to get out of a deadlock, it would clearly be stated in Article 368, and there's nothing about a deadlock in Article 368. So, the only way to avoid this deadlock is to nip it in the bud and not allow any change in the first place so that the constitution machinery would function smoothly. So Article 368 implicitly says that no house can change any provision of a constitution amendment bill once it is presented in the house, and all these bodies can do is either assent it or reject it. Now, since the actual parliament didn't even have these powers, the provisional parliament can be the recipient of these powers through Article 379, and it shouldn't have amended the bill after it was presented in the house. And for this reason, this amendment is invalid. To this, the state said that this argument has no merit because Article 107 and 108 clearly talk about amending the bills in both the chambers, and the constitution bills are to be dealt in the same manner. So amendments to any bill must be allowed without any precondition. On this aspect, the Supreme Court held that Article 368 first isn't a comprehensive code, and there are a few obvious gaps on procedure in Article 368. And keeping these gaps in mind, Article 118 empowers the Parliament to make its own rules for conduct of business, and this includes a procedure in case of a deadlock to a constitution amendment bill. The petitioners also argued that since the amendment takes away our fundamental rights, and Article 13 clearly forbids the state from enacting any law that violates our fundamental rights, this amendment is invalid. Again, this is because law also includes constitutional law, so an amendment to the constitution means an amendment to a law. Recognizing the sanctity of fundamental rights and constitution in general, the framers wanted to protect the constitution from amendments according to the whims and ideologies of the parties in power. For this reason, the framers put a few obstacles in place after perusing constitutions of major democratic countries. And since the fundamental rights chapter was inspired by the American Constitution, and American Constitution prohibits the US Congress from amending the fundamental rights, it is obvious that our constitution prohibits the parliament from amending the fundamental rights. So, the essence of Article 368 was completely obliterated when this provisional parliament, a single body, amended the constitution. So, for this reason, this amendment should be declared unconstitutional and invalid. The petitioners also argued that by virtue of Article 379, the provisional parliament has certain powers, and attached to these powers are responsibilities and duties. These duties are obvious from the phrase "perform all the duties of the parliament" in Article 379. In this case, it is a duty of the provisional parliament to protect the fundamental rights. So, if anything, this provisional parliament should protect our fundamental rights and not to do the opposite, that is encroaching our fundamental rights. And since this provisional parliament did encroach on our fundamental rights, this amendment is unconstitutional. The state countered to this argument by saying the use of phrase "perform all duties of parliament" in Article 379 does not in any manner cut down the power of the provisional parliament, because Article 13 does not impose any duty on the parliament. And also, there's no conflict between exercising powers of parliament under Article 379 and the prohibition in Article 13. That's it. This was the state's argument. On this issue too, the Supreme Court rejected the arguments of the petitioners and held that different constitutions have different methods of amendment. For example, a few conduct a referendum, another few by a special convention, and another by legislation under special procedure. So it goes on and on. Now, just looking at our own constitution, it clearly tells us which method our framers chose. That too after considering all democratic constitutions. So these things cannot be compared to similar provisions in other constitutions. We have our own method. On the other issue, the Supreme Court rejected the arguments of the petitioners and held that we agree that constitution gave fundamental rights a lot of value and sanctity because it has put special difficulties in place to amend the fundamental rights. Now, normally, law also includes constitutional law, and there's a clear distinction between legislative power and constituent power. The legislative power is primarily concerned with the executive branch. So, a law as defined in Article 13 will only come into play if it's a law that deals with making laws for the executive, legislature, and judiciary. And the word law here means just rules and regulations, because the framers used the word law in Article 13 to protect invasions of rights by the executive bodies, not from the sovereign constitution, constituent power to amend the constitution. had they wanted to absolutely protect the fundamental rights as they were originally included, they would have simply added a provision excluding them from being amended in Article 368 itself. And since there were no such limitations in Article 368, the Parliament is deemed to have absolute power to amend the constitution. So the power of Parliament to amend the constitution, the constituent power, has no limits. And Article 13 and Article 368 must be construed harmoniously. So Article 13 doesn't come in the way while amending fundamental rights, and Article 13 doesn't come in the way of Article 368. Before going ahead, keep in mind that the original Article 368 didn't have the word Parliament in it. It just had the phrase either house of the Parliament. The current day Article 368 has the word Parliament along with the phrase constituent power. And also its title was amended from procedure for amendment of the constitution to power of the Parliament to amend the constitution and the procedure thereof. And all these changes were made through three whole amendments, but this is an issue for another episode. The other argument went on like this. The body that amends the constitution is one body, and the body that prepares laws is a different body. Article 368 was not intended to be used by the provisional parliament by the framers. So Article 379 just granted the legislative powers to the provisional parliament with which they can enact normal laws. Also, Parliament consists of three different entities, Lok Sabha, Rajya Sabha, and the President. So, it's plain and obvious that Lok Sabha is a different body, Rajya Sabha is a different body, and the office of the President is another body. All these three independent entities are collectively referred to as the Parliament. So, it is implied that Lok Sabha, Rajya Sabha, and President are completely independent and separate functioning bodies. Now, Article 368 says that a bill can only be presented either in Lok Sabha or Rajya Sabha, and after getting requisite approval from both the houses, it requires the assent of the President to come into force. While passing bills on amendment to the constitution, Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha are considered as separate and independent entities and not as a part of the parliament. This separate and independent body consists of 2/3 of the members of Lok Sabha and 2/3 of members of Rajya Sabha, and then the president, as opposed to parliament, which consists of all the members of Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha and president. So essentially, this new body is different from the parliament. And the only common connection of these two bodies is that all the candidates of these two bodies happen to be members of the parliament. For the sake of a convenience, let's call this body amending parliament. Amending parliament. So the petitioners went on to argue that members of Lok Sabha, Rajya Sabha, and president wear different hats while performing different tasks. So while framing laws, they're part of the parliament, and while amending the constitution, they're exercising their constituent power as members of this different body, which we call amending parliament. This distinction is clear when we look at Articles 2, 3, 20, 33 and 34. In these articles, the constitution specifically used the word parliament while empowering the parliament to perform a few actions. So it means the constitution knew that there were two different bodies. So they made that distinction by just using the word parliament whenever required and impliedly referred to amending parliament in Article 368. So that's why the word parliament is purposefully avoided in Article 368. And the phrases either house of the parliament and 2/3 of the majority were explicitly used to make it clear that this amending parliament is different from the normal parliament. The petitioners went on to argue that now amending parliament is different from the actual parliament, and the parliament has no power to amend the constitution. Since the provisional parliament is a recipient of powers of the parliament, and since this parliament has no power to amend the constitution, the provisional parliament does not have the power to amend the constitution. So this amendment is not valid. So, the petitioners concluded by saying that since amending parliament is different from the actual parliament and Article 379 only granted the powers of the actual parliament, this amendment is unconstitutional because the provisional parliament is just the recipient of the powers of the actual parliament. And since this parliament itself has no powers to amend the constitution, the provisional parliament didn't inherit these powers. To these arguments, the state countered by arguing that The Parliament's power to make amendments and statutes flow from the same authority, that is, the Parliament. This reasoning can be informed from a reading of Articles 2, 3 and 4, which say that 2/3 of majority isn't required if any changes are made to Schedule 1 and Schedule 4, and any change to them shall not be considered as an amendment to the Constitution. These articles and corresponding schedules delineate the territories of state and the number of elected representatives prescribed per state and similar details. And for any changes to these things, just a simple majority will do the work. And another example would be Article 240, which allows the president in a few situations to make legislations with just a stroke of pen. And there's no need for an approval from parliament or state legislatures, and all of these are considered as an amendment to the Constitution. So from all of this, it is obvious that the amending power and legislative power flows from the same body, that is the parliament. The different majority, as argued by the petitioners, is merely procedural. So from all of this, it is obvious that the amending power and legislative power flows from the same body, the parliament, and it's just a different type of approval for an amendment to the Constitution. So the amendment was very much valid. The state also argued that the procedure described in this article doesn't mean that the parliament's powers are to be exercised by a fluctuating body of varying majority and not by the parliament. On the other aspect, the state argued that the amendment doesn't fall under the definition of law under Article 13, because the law mentioned in Article 13 means just an ordinary legislation like Indian Contracts Act or the Penal Code or the Stamps Act. And since this is a constitutional amendment, Article 13 won't apply here, as Article 31A and 31B are not legislative in character. On this issue, the Supreme Court, while rejecting this lengthy argument of the petitioners, held that the requirement of a different type of majority is merely procedural, and this can by itself be no reason for entrusting the amending power to a different body, and a perusal of Article 368 confirms this view. The final argument by the petitioners was, since the subject of land is in List 2 in Schedule 7, which is the state list, and states alone have the power to deal with any issues relating to land, be it laws, policies, orders, or anything. But here, the provisional parliament has encroached on the state's exclusive power by changing property rights through Article 31. Now, parliament could not validate a law which it does not even have the power to enact. So, the provisional parliament could not insert land legislations in Schedule 9. Because that would be encroaching on the state's exclusive power. And Articles 31A and 31B, despite being provisions of the Constitution, they are legislative in character. The Provisional Parliament exceeded its power to amend the Constitution by inserting these legislations in Schedule 9. So for this reason, this amendment must be declared unconstitutional. Rejecting this argument, the Supreme Court held that the amendment just seeks to insulate a few laws from judicial interference, and it doesn't interfere with the regulation of land in any which way. And this amendment is not some law or a policy or any regulation on land, but just an amendment to the Constitution. So, it is the Parliament alone which is empowered to pass an amendment of this nature. And this amendment in no way affects the matters on state list. This argument only holds good when the parliament validates a law which the state passes without no power to pass such law. So finally, after these lengthy battles in the Supreme Court, the first ever constitutional bench upheld the first amendment to the Constitution, and the states were allowed to acquire lands of the zamindars. In all the states, the government had actually assigned all the acquired lands to the farmers, and the zamindars were left with just a handful of lands. Here, one thing I didn't understand is that why did the president pass the Constitution Removal of Difficulties Order No. 2? Because Article 379 already empowered the provisional parliament to perform all the tasks of the parliament as if it were a parliament. So, share your thoughts on why the president passed this order in the comment section of this same episode on our YouTube channel, Hamlet of Law. Also, zamindars were put to a huge loss after the mandatory acquisition, because contrary to the popular belief, zamindars were not just given lands out of thin air. they had a lot of duties and liabilities by virtue of them being an owner to all of these lands. For example, the British would just take away the lands from the zamindars if they failed to pay them the yearly tax, and would very easily replace these old zamindars with another person who promises to pay the same or more tax. So imagine the government just barges in and takes over Reliance or Tata or Adani Group in its entirety and give no compensation to the shareholders. The acquisition of zamindari lands was somewhat similar to this. On the other hand, the government had to do it. It had no other option. Suppose if in an area, a handful of people own all the water available, and if they refuse to share this water with anyone unless they comply to their terms or pay them some money, the government has to take care of it, and government has to take control of it and do something about it. So, in this case, there was no other option for the government to do it. At the same time, the government couldn't afford to compensate for all the lands it acquired, so there was no middle ground to reach to. The government acquired all of these lands without compensating the owners. Also, the government could have just waited until the full parliament was formed, especially on the issue of zamindari abolition laws. And I somewhat agree that the government needed to restrict free speech to maintain public order, but on the zamindari abolition and reservation front, the government could have simply waited. Because it was not like if the Congress doesn't do it, no one would do it. The major contender to the Congress party, the Communist Party of India, was even more extreme on these issues of reservation and abolition of zamindari system. So I feel the amendment wasn't just about providing way for social progress and to maintain public order. There has been an element of appeasing the citizens to get votes. Now, the ratio on provisional parliament and its powers did not again come into question because the full parliament was formed immediately in the next year, in 1952. But the ratio in the three rulings in this case, the first one was that law as mentioned in Article 13 doesn't include constitutional amendment, so the parliament is free to amend all parts of the constitution. The second one being fundamental rights can be amended absolutely. And finally, the third one, that full protection can be granted to laws inserted in Schedule 9. So all these three aspects were overruled and upheld in different cases. The first issue, that law in Article 13 doesn't include constitution amendment, was rejected in the famous Golaknath case. And that case held that law in Article 13 also includes an amendment to the constitution, so the parliament can't amend fundamental rights. But again, in Kesavananda Bharati case, the court reversed Golaknath's ratio and upheld Shankari Prasad's ruling that law in Article 13 doesn't include constitutional law, so it doesn't come in the way of Article 368 power in any way. But the Kesavananda Bharati case also introduced something called the basic structure of the constitution and held that the parliament can't change this basic structure of the constitution at any cost. But the case didn't define what exactly the basic structure is, but it just gave a few examples like federalism, democracy, and independence of judiciary, and so on and on. So the Kesavananda case accorded the tag of basic features to a few provisions in the constitution and then held that the parliament can amend the constitution including the fundamental rights, but if these fundamental rights happen to be a part of the basic structure of the constitution, that amendment to that extent would be invalid. So this interpretation that law in Article 13 doesn't include an amendment to the constitution holds the ground as on today. On the Schedule 9 aspect, the court suggested the level of protection and validity of this Schedule 9 in a series of judgments. But in IR Koyolo case, the Supreme Court held that laws can be placed in Schedule 9. And by virtue of this, all these laws will gain certain protection granted to this schedule. But if these laws violate the basic features of the constitution, the courts can't exercise their judicial review and the courts can't nullify these laws. It doesn't matter whether these laws were inserted in Schedule 9 because the basic features of the constitution reign supreme. So, as of now, not all fundamental rights are basic features of the constitution, but just a handful of them. So, laws inserted in Schedule 9 can still be valid if they violate certain fundamental rights, not all of them. So, this is the First Amendment to the Constitution and the Supreme Court's decision on it. And this Shankari Prasad case is a case that sparked off the debate on the amending power of the Constitution, which ultimately ended with the basic structure theory in the Kesavananda Bharati case. There'll be a lot of future episodes discussing the Sajjan Singh case, where the amending power was again challenged. And then there's Golaknath case, there's Kesava Ananda Bharati case, there's Meena Ramil's case, and a whole lot of other cases. So stay tuned to Hamlet of Law. The PDF version of this episode will be found on www.thelawreporter.in. This is your host Naren Rudra, signing off.